Hello, I'm Alex Zane, film journalist, movie fan, and your host for A Trip to the Movies. I'm a Pisces, I like long walks in the country, cozy nights by the fire, and I haven't been in the sea since I was 5 years old when I watched Jaws. Thank you very much for downloading the show. We've got a brilliant guest on the way. This episode is brought to you by Odeon, and if you've been to watch a film at Odeon lately, you'll know that nothing beats that cinematic feeling. It's not just about stuffing your face with delicious popcorn, although, let's be honest, that helps. It's your head. Standing on end, your palms sweating and being transported somewhere magical. It's about feeling every footstep of some giant lumbering monster. It's car chases, space battles, and your heart beating out of your chest. It's about feeling cinematic, and nobody does that better than Odeon. Head to odeon.co.uk or download their app to book your next adventure today. And if you'd like to watch the following interview in glorious Technicolor, head over to our YouTube channel and subscribe for all the latest updates. And to get in touch with us, you'll find us at Trip to Movies Pod. That's at Trip to Movies Pod on social media, absolutely everywhere. Right then, time to introduce today's guest, who I interviewed in person in London, Soho, but 2 Earth days ago. So if you're ready, let's begin. Welcome to A Trip to the Movies, where each week a special guest takes us on their perfect night out at the cinema. Today, guiding us through their personal paradise of film is an incredible comedian and actor who shot to fame as part of the brilliant comedy series Goodness Gracious Me, followed by the hugely successful The Kumars at Number 42, before taking on more dramatic roles in The Indian Doctor, Unforgotten, and most recently as part of Netflix's adaptation of Neil Gaiman's The Sandman. But perhaps his crowning televisual achievement was staying up all night to watch the Oscars with me on Sky Cinema. Taking us on today's trip to the movies, it's the wonderful Sanjeev Bhaskar.
Thank you very much. That's brought back a very kind of specific memory, actually, doing the Oscars coverage, because we were there the evening of the false win, La La Land and Moonlight.
Almost, well, I was going to say the biggest moment in Oscar history, but Will Smith took that as a challenge.
Yeah. Actually, that's probably what he did, wasn't it? Everyone was saying, gosh, you know what the most memorable moment in Oscar history is? At La La La. And he was going, wait a minute, I can top that. I don't know how, but I'll top it.
I bet Sky are going to do Oscar countdown shows of the most memorable moments, and I want to be number one. So, listen, comedian, actor, TV presenter, author, like I could go on with the different titles I could give you, but is there one at this stage in your career that you feel encapsulates Sanjeev Bhaskar right now? And I will say you can pick all of them and even add to the list if you like.
Okay. Well, I certainly wouldn't add to the list. No, I don't know, really. I kind of, I don't know, anything else sounds a bit wanky, to be quite honest, because you want to go creative force, ethereal artist. But no, I've just been really lucky to have done, you know, a bit of film, a bit of telly, a bit of theatre, and a bit of radio. And I love it all. I love, at the core of it, what I really love is the collaboration. The very idea that you and I could come up with an idea that I could never have come up with on my own. It, to me, is, okay, that's collaboration. That's kind of collaborate with everyone, because, you know, even if the idea that you're given sometimes isn't the best one, it may lead to the best one. And so I love that. And film really, for me, encapsulates, I think it's the greatest art form, because, you know, people will kind of say, you know, with perhaps some, you know, good argument, music, because it crosses boundaries and it sustains and it evolves, gets reinterpreted and stuff like that. So there's, you know, music, fine art, of course, architecture, all of those things. The written word, of course, is an art. Film combines all of it and then adds things like editing and special effects and things like that. So I think it's the greatest art form. And it's also the one that requires the greatest collaboration, because from the first day, you know, the person puts pen to paper. Do they put pen to paper anymore? Probably not.
Final draft, isn't it?
Finger, yeah. Digit to keyboard. that is just the beginning of the journey, and it constantly evolves. As an actor, you kind of arrive on the set with a script. Then there's the director who adds his take on it, the choice of shots, you know, angles, everything else. And then ultimately, once you've done your bit, then it goes to an editor. and they play with it and they move it around. And then musicians come in and add a soundscape to it. And then you get the finished thing. So, you know, whenever I've, on the rare occasions where I've had to, you'd been on a film review show with a film I really didn't like, I'm painfully aware of how many people have worked on it. Mm. And I make a mental note not to make sure that I say kind of at least two good things about the film, because, you know, when ultimately you slag off a film and you go, well, that was shit. Well, that was a shit film. God, I was so bored. I wish I'd walked out. It was terrible. And that's usually about the acting, the directing, the story, the writing. But you're also trashing the costume people and the makeup people and the people who did the set. Mm. So the, all that stuff. So I'm really mindful of that. So, you know, I'll sort of go, yeah, let me find two good things to say about it.
Although if I was listening to a review and they went, so the costumes are great.
Yeah, yeah.
I probably wouldn't go and see the film.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, I don't think anyone has gone to see the film because someone said the writing was awful, the acting was terrible, the direction was really shoddy. Costumes were wonderful. Right, I'm going to that. How long is it? 4 hours? Yeah, brilliant.
It's interesting what you say about collaboration, because since your start in the at the entertainment industry, let's call it, you have been collaborating. You were initially a double act and then you moved into... Goodness gracious me, which was obviously a huge, huge TV show. And we're going back, what, 25 years now to when it I know it was on Radio 4 first, but 1998 it came on BBC Two. And back then TV was, like terrestrial TV, before streamers and everything, was huge. Do you remember what it was like watching that go out on that very first night on BBC Two?
I do. We all got together to watch it because it was such a freaky experience because, you know, it was on that little rectangular thing that you'd grown up with watching stuff and being inspired by stuff and, you know, maybe kind of aspiring to and all that sort of stuff. So suddenly to be on that same box was incredible. And, I felt the same way when I did a film and I went to see a film because, again, my association with going to the cinema was seeing other people do, you know, hopefully amazing stuff or at least having good costumes. It was quite a – it's a weird thing, actually, especially with film, because the thing I still haven't quite got used to is that, particularly in a cinema release, you go and sit in the auditorium and you kind of, in my case, have to watch yourself on a big screen. It is like someone has taken a kind of, you know, 30 foot by 50 foot still of your face and then blown it up. And so you kind of see every nook and cranny and what you see as defects and, you know, everything else. And so I don't think there's a film I've done where I haven't, certainly in the cinema, where I haven't at some point gone, God, you've got a big nose. Flipping heck, you got a big nose. Don't turn it. Oh, blimey, the double chin. You know, why did you look down at that point? With TV as well, anything that I'm in, I feel I have to watch it because that's the only way you're going to sort of self-analyze and improve, hopefully. But I generally have to watch it on my own first so I can get that first ego view out of the way. And then I can watch it for what it is.
I should say on the subject of goodness gracious me, a huge congratulations to your wife, Mira Sayal, for her BAFTA 2 nights ago.
Thank you very much. Yeah, she got the fellowship, which was brilliant, which, you know, should be added, you know, of the ring. I don't know. It's kind of in it's BAFTA.
It's lying there. It's waiting.
No one's done it. I mean, she's kind of been, you know, incredibly... essential to new voices coming through on the screen and incredibly impactful. I mean, everything from screenplays like Bargee on the Beach to Anita and Me, which was an adaptation of her own book, and to, you know, collaborating on Goodness Gracious Me and the Kumars and the Split, you know, in terms of that's separate from the acting career, which is, you know, has been pretty special as well. So, yeah, it was fabulous. It was an interesting moment because they... you know, they did a kind of clip reel thing of her stuff. And somebody from BAFTA afterwards said to me, you know, that was lovely. And I said, yes, it was. And her speech, Mira's speech was fantastic. And he said, you were kind of featured quite a lot in that clip. And I said, yeah, do you know what? I mean, featured enough to make me want to say, me? I said, you could have put me less in the clips, to be quite honest. That would have been a little easier to deal with. But... No, it's a fabulous achievement, and we're obviously super proud of it.
Where has it gone? Where's the BAFTA gone? Where are you putting
okay,
it?
Okay, so this is a weird thing. So I've got how do I couch this? One of my favorite programs growing up was Thunderbirds. I loved Thunderbirds. I still do, actually.
Yeah.
It was so cinematic. Yeah. I mean, the music, Barry Gray's music, was phenomenal and just elevated it. And a few years ago, they found some records that had been made in 1965, which were audio versions, audio adventures of Thunderbirds with the original voice cast. And they thought, well, there was a project where they which they crowdfunded, which was to basically make those episodes. We've got the soundtrack. We've got the voices. Let's just build the puppets and build the the Thunderbird vehicles and do it in the way that they did it, using some of the original people who were involved. And it's of its time. Obviously, it was 1965. But in one of the episodes, Lady Penelope and Parker go to the Himalayas, where they meet their international rescue Indian agent.
Okay.
and they said to me, look, David Graham, who did the voice of Parker, he did the voice, and it was very much a bloke in, an old white guy, 1965, doing an Indian accent.
The Peter Sellers School of Indian accents.
But worse.
Okay.
It was somebody who didn't, if it was a 3-day course, he went up until the first lunchtime and said, I've learned enough. I can do this. And I said, look, that's fine. It's of its time. I absolutely understand. But they said, look, there was a tradition of building Thunderbird puppets with someone's likeness. Can we do that of you? And I went, you cannot believe how much of an honor that is. So, very long-winded way of telling you that at the end of the shoot, they gave me my puppet, which is about 2 feet high, actually. So that is sitting in a glass box in one of our rooms, and the BAFTA is now sitting next to it. I feel they're equivalent in many ways.
Whoa, wonderful. That's amazing. BAFTA and your likeness, Marianne.
I will show you. I'll show you a picture later.
Oh, yes, I would love to see that. I want to talk Sandman, obviously. Mm. The Sandman, they did make us wait. They did make us wait, Netflix. It was like, well, we're just correlating some figures, but the second season is confirmed. Have you started filming yet?
We haven't started filming. I've seen, I think I've seen 5 scripts. So I've read the first 5 eps, and it's epic. I mean, I as a punter, I loved the first series. I loved the fact that I didn't know the comics that well, actually. I thought as a series, I thought it was fabulous. And the change in tone from episode to episode, I really liked, because you were telling multiple stories in the same world, with some of them loosely connected, but sort of all of them adding in terms of atmosphere and background. And I really loved it. I thought it was fabulous. And so it's very exciting to be reading the script.
Excellent. I wish I'd been forewarned. I watched the Banshees of Inisherin, and about 2 weeks later, I got to episode 2 of The Sandman. And having just got over Daisy's death in The Banshees of Inisherin, I had to then sit through what I consider an even more painful goodbye between yourself and Gregory the Gargoyle. It's heartbreaking. I cried my eyes out.
It was really lovely to film it. I'd never filmed with, it's not green screen exactly, is it? It's green person, which you really have to get your head around, because it was a bloke in a green leotard, which was immediately amusing in the middle of a greenery, who's holding the head. And so he's moving the head around as to where it's going to be. And then you have to get all emotional about it. And it's actually much more difficult to remove from your vision the bloke in the green leotard. But he did a fantastic job, because in the end, actually, we just did. It's that weird thing where you just go, yeah, that's okay. That's Gregory. Mm. It's a obviously very fit guy, but in green leotard.
I can't tell you how much, this is what I was hoping you'd do. Pull back the curtain so I could then remember that scene in a very different way. Because every time I think about it, I get like very, very emotional. It's a beautiful scene though.
It was lovely. It was lovely to do. Really lovely to do.
The one other thing, I just want to mention this because I have a thank you to make to you. And I can't remember what it was, but many, many years ago, you were on television talking beautifully about Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and the importance of that book to you. And I'd never read it. And following on from listening to you talk about it, I immediately read it and have loved it ever since. And I think you were sitting in a meadow underneath some stars.
Yeah, do you know what? I remember exactly what that was. It was called the BBC Big Read, and they were trying to find, I think it was the 5 or 10 most popular books as voted by the British public. And so they had a number of people, I think 20 people initially, that were advocating for a book. And so I advocated for that. And one of the reasons I remember it so well was that when we shot the little doc, it was about half an hour where you kind of, you know, you were interviewed about it and you talked about it. But we were able to, play out scenes from it. So I got to play Arthur Dent. And it was just a dream come true to play Arthur Dent in Hitchhiker's Guide. And I mean, I listened to it on the radio when I was a kid and I thought it was amazing. And then there was a TV series that came out, which was quite good. But the film, which I wasn't a huge fan of, but the books were just brilliant. It was that, I think they're uniquely British. I think that's the other thing, which is that they're quite Python-esque. Mm. You've got that element in there. You've got the satire in there as well. But just the kind of leaps of imagination that were made in the book, I think, are kind of extraordinary. And, you know, things like the Babel fish, which is a little fish that you stick in your ear and then you can speak any other language. And, you know, in a way, we're not that far with the technology to do that kind of thing. One of my favorite characters, and I can't, Bo something the Great Order, but his job, he only appears in one scene, actually. His job was to basically insult everyone in the universe once. So the scene is just kind of like, you know, an English village cricket game where the batter is about to, he's got about 4 balls left. He's going to win the game. He's going to be fine. And suddenly this kind of spaceship descends and just kills everybody. And this guy walks through the mist and just walks up to him and goes, "You're a worthless piece of shit." And then just turns around and walks off. It's brilliant. Loved it.
Oh, yeah. The movie. I will say the costumes are great in the film.
Weren't they wonderful?
I have a fondness for Alan Rickman. His voice acting is obviously superb. And Sam Rockwell has never done anything wrong in my eyes as an actor.
I couldn't agree with you more. Mm. I think it's phenomenal.
Amazing. Just amazing. Well, seeing as we are talking about film, we don't have to wait any longer to head to our virtual cinema. So let's leave this plane of reality for a celluloid realm. Sanjeev, you're about to take us on your perfect night out at the cinema. You're our guide. We're your audience. Let's go on a trip to the movies. So, we push open the doors to our temple of film and find ourselves in the foyer. There's an excited buzz, as there always is in a cinema foyer, the hum of anticipation. Mm. It's your perfect cinema trip, Sanjeev. Who have you picked, living or dead, to go with you?
You know, this is quite a difficult one, really, as I have given this some thought because it's obviously friends of mine and great filmmakers would be fabulous to go and see a film with. And I've been lucky enough to do that on a couple of occasions with real filmmakers. I'm going to go for Elvis Presley.
The King.
I'm going to go for the King. Elvis was a huge movie fan. And one of the things that I discovered in my lifelong kind of passion for all things Elvis was that there were 3 kind of touch points that crossed with me and Elvis in terms of films that he loved. One was James Bond. He loved the Bond films. And so in Memphis, he would rent out the theater at night, do an all-nighter with his pals, and he would watch the Bond films, which is great. He loved Peter Sellers, huge Peter Sellers fan. And so that was a great crossover. Doctor Strangelove he loved, and Pink Panther and everything else. But the unusual one, and I suppose the biggest crossover, was he was a huge Python fan.
I had no idea.
Massive Monty Python fan. And so I got to know and become friends with the youngest member of the Memphis Mafia, a guy called Jerry Schilling, who was Elvis's buddy, from just after he started. And I kind of verified it with him. And I said, look, is this true? And he said, yeah. He said he would, you know, they'd play touch football or something. And, you know, if Elvis got, you know, hurt or something, and they go, you know, Elvis, you okay? You okay? He'd do the, just put a scratch.
he could quote the Holy Grail. Wow.
Yeah, yeah, and bits and pieces from it. I mean, does your wife go? Does she go? I mean, it's mind-boggling. It's mind-boggling.
Wow.
But, yeah. So he loved Python. And so I think that, in fact, when Python was first shown in America, the first place they could show it or did show it was a kind of cable station in the South. I think it was Dallas or somewhere like that. So he may have got access to it before the rest of America.
This is great. This is reopened. It has, you know, when students across the country are quoting Python at university. That's what everyone does. But no one's quoting it in Elvis's voice. This has reopened that possibility. You got to cut down the tallest tree in the forest with a herring. It's great.
Oh, that's the signee. We brought you strawberry.
There are those who call me Tim. Wonderful, wonderful. Now we are reliving our student days. Wonderful. So what's your relationship with Elvis, though? When did you discover him?
When I was really little. I mean, it's a strange thing. I kind of heard him first on the radio, and I loved his voice. And as a kid, it was probably Teddy Bear or something that's kind of kid-related that I liked. But over the years, I just thought, I really like his voice. And it took me a long time to work out what it was about his voice that I liked. And I think there is a vulnerability in it. And I think that when you look for it, then you kind of see it. And even, you know, in his kind of, you know, even in Hound Dog or any, you know, any of those kind of the upbeat early kind of Elvis classics, there's a feeling of a young soul that's through there. And I found that throughout. And the weird thing was, it was about, gosh, you know, maybe 6-7 years before I saw what he looked like. And I remember when I saw what he looked like, I thought, well, of course you look like that. You know, it's one of those, with that voice, of course you look like this kind of, you know, chiseled Greek god. It was very, very early on. And it's never quite left.
Favorite on-screen Elvis? I mean, there's a few.
In terms of actors?
In terms of, you've got your Kurt Russell, you've got Val Kilmer.
You have.
Obviously, more recent one.
I have to say, with Austin Butler, he facially doesn't look anything like him. Mm. But knowing, you know, the Elvis canon as well as I do, I've not seen anyone capture his physicality as well as him. And it's that wonderful thing where, it's an interesting thing about the movie Elvis, which is that in every Elvis film in which Elvis was an actor, and I think he did 29 as an actor, he did 33 films overall, some of which in performances early on are really good. King Creole particularly, I think he's brilliant. It's an actor's performance. And Flaming Star, which was directed by Don Siegel, I think is a really great performance. But in all of the Elvis movies or movies about Elvis, Elvis is larger than life. He's the biggest thing in the film. And I thought what was really interesting about Baz Luhrmann's film was that the world around Elvis was bigger than the character. Mm. And so it told a story of a person with all the kind of, you know, the dazzle that Baz Luhrmann brings to his films. I thought that he brought that vulnerability to that character, which I'd not seen in, you know, whether it was a John Carpenter one or in any of the other guys who've played him. And so I thought it was remarkable. And I was listening to an interview not that long ago with Baz Luhrmann said that Austin Butler, with those scenes that they'd done at the Louisiana Hayride and then the Vegas shows and then the 68 comeback special, which, you know, probably if you squeeze them all together amount to maybe about 10-12 minutes in the film. But Austin Butler did the entire concert. They filmed the entire concert.
I didn't know that.
Three or four times. So he's got, Baz Luhrmann has got four Elvis concerts as performed by Austin Butler. And Austin Butler had obviously watched all that footage and had just choreographed himself to the nth degree to get it right. So Baz Luhrmann kind of said, you know, one day I might kind of put that out there, but that will be very, very interesting to see.
Yeah. I mean, what a committed performance. I think I read an interview with Austin Butler saying he thought his voice might never return to his natural speaking voice, having adopted Elvis's for so long and in such a committed fashion.
Wouldn't it be great if his natural talking voice was high-pitched Geordie? Do you find these really early shots of him going, really like Elvis? I think he's totally great, like.
And then no, it's just, then he's just stuck down here the whole time.
But yeah, it was I thought I loved it. I loved it more the second time, actually.
Right. There's a clock on the wall of the foyer. It reads a specific time. What time of day have we gone to the cinema?
Well, I'll go to the cinema any time of day, but I've got a particular affinity of going into a cinema when it's light outside and then coming out when it's dark. There's something about having been on a physical journey then, and hopefully the journey that the film has taken you on, but you come out and the world has changed, and that I've always loved that. So depending on what time of year, I don't know, 4 or 5 o'clock maybe.
Okay, I'll put you down for 5 p.m.
Five p.m. Yeah, I'm free then. Yeah.
So bearing in mind the kind of work that you do and that I do, obviously it's scattershot when you might be working. So you have days free here and there. You've never been a fan of just sort of going, I have nothing on today. I could literally go to the cinema at, say, midday, even 11 in the morning.
Do you know what? I had a real fear of going to the cinema on my own when I was younger. There was something about, and this is just a personal thing, which was that I thought everyone or anyone who's in the cinema is going to look at me and go, Billy, no mates. He's got no friends because probably he's got a really crap personality and bad personal hygiene. And so I avoided it. And then the first film I went to see on my own, and it was exactly one of those things. It was kind of, I had a day free, and I really wanted to go and see Reservoir Dogs. And I went to see Reservoir Dogs on my own, and there were probably about, I don't know, 15 or 20 people there in the cinema. And I had to fight the urge to get up and turn around to everyone in the audience and say, I just want to explain, I do have friends. It's just that I have a free day and I really wanted to see this new film. I just wanted you to know that. I had to really fight it. But actually, once I'd done that, then it was great. Then it was great.
Right then, 5 p.m. So you have booked the tickets for our trip. Which seat have you picked in the auditorium?
If it's ideal, I would always go kind of in the middle. And the center and just slightly higher, because I think you get the full sort of, scope of the screen there. And I don't like the extreme on the sides. I really don't like, and I really don't like being at the front, kind of looking up and then having to crane my head around. Slightly higher than center back. I can see the entire screen and then I can obviously choose to look at, what I want to, and I think that as when you're making a film, that's what you have in mind. I don't think you think of it by going, I'm in the extreme left at the front. What will my film look like from there? So, yeah, that one.
Now, the required follow-up question to picking, what is the most popular seat you've chosen on the show, the middle, in the center? What happens if you need the toilet?
I've got great bladder control.
Jealous.
I have never needed to go, I will go beforehand.
Okay.
Obviously. I mean, it depends on how long the film is. I mean, if it's a kind of 90-minute, two-hour film, you can probably get through that. I'm thinking if you kind of went in to see, actually, even with Lawrence of Arabia or Dr. Zhivago or something like that, it's probably why they put an interval in.
So that leads me on to my next question. Are you championing the return of the interval if your film exceeds 2 hours, 45 minutes, say?
I think if it exceeds three, then 2:45. The thing is, I grew up on Bollywood films. Bollywood films are standard length, 3 hours. And they all had a built-in interval, the intermission, Simon would come up. And so, yeah, it kind of depends on the film, doesn't it? But I mean, in a sense, you know, if you think about any of the great trilogies, they are effectively one big story, which you've got kind of two huge intermissions of kind of a couple of years between them. But people do that thing, of course, of going to see, you know, all of the Lord of the Rings in one sort of day or whatever, 9 hours of kind of viewing.
Bliss.
Yeah, I'd love to say that. But it was, so yeah, I think that, I mean, the only annoying thing about the interval is, and I remember this is, I'm recalling from my Bollywood going days when I was a kid, is that, you know, people just choose to come back when they want to come back. And so that was slightly annoying. And also, I mean, for me, as a kid, in West London, where we used to go, the interval was when everybody headed out to get snacks. Mm-hmm. They didn't get them beforehand because they knew there was an interval there. And so people would be coming back into darkness, you know, carrying, you know, various kind of snacks and stuff. And they wouldn't know where their families were. They wouldn't know where their seats were because it was that dark. And I'm pretty sure it's not a racist thing to say, but I'll say it anyway, which is that, you know, in the dark, you know, big extended Indian families all pretty much look alike. And so you wouldn't know. And so you would get, you know, the film started. And so the only light that was in there was coming off the screen. And you would get, you know, people with their trays of teas usually. I mean, it was hot drinks. It wasn't kind of cold drinks. It, you know, hot drinks, trying to balance kind of like eight teas and sort of various snacks. And the only unoriginal thing they could think of saying as they'd come in, you know, down the aisles was, "Where are you?" And people would just go, "Here." And they'd go, and they would, you know, they'd hand the teas over. And it was only when a, you know, bright bit of the screen came on, they went, "You're not my family." And they were kind of like, so all of that was going on. So there was all that extra drama, which was quite good fun, actually, I have to say. But so, yeah, so I am a fan of the intermission.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like a health and safety nightmare.
Yeah, it was awful. There was no health. There was no safety. It was just kids running up and down the aisle. It was, I remember pigeons flying around in the screen. I mean, it was.
Where were you watching Bollywood films as a kid?
This was in Southall in West London, which was a big kind of South Asian population. And they had three cinemas there that would exclusively show Bollywood films. And so particularly, you know, on Fridays, Saturdays and Sundays, they would be absolutely packed. I mean, it would, I mean, if they were single screen theaters. So I think the largest one I remember had, called the Dominion, had a balcony as well. So I don't know how many that would have been. It might have been 600, 700, maybe 1,000. I mean, you know, big.
And is the atmosphere similar to like watching a Bollywood film? Are people sort of quiet and engaged, or is it a much more voluminous experience?
Yeah, it's the latter. It's seen as interactive, and so, you know, people will kind of, you know, boo the villain and cheer a piece of dialogue, or cheer when the good guy kind of beats up the bad guy. You know, sing along to the songs. I mean, it was, nobody got up and danced or anything, but particularly because poetry is such a kind of big part of sort of, you know, South Asian culture, that dialogue would be very poetic. And so if there was a particular line of dialogue, you know, people would vocally respond to it. So yeah, it's a very, very different experience. I remember going to see a Bollywood film in Trinidad when I was filming. I did a Merchant Ivory film when we were filming there. And I went there, and for them, most of them didn't speak the language. Yet the experience was exactly the same. They were still interactive with it. You know, so it becomes a much more symbiotic thing.
Weirdly, I've been to Trinidad quite a lot. My dad lives there. Was it at the open air theater, or was it indoors?
No, it was indoors. Oh, it was indoors. I'd love to have seen something at the open air.
Yeah, it's quite nice. Yeah. If they had the same weather here, that would be lovely.
Yeah.
Okay. The final thing we need to do before we leave the foyer. Oh, can you smell that? It's the air, thick with the smells of every kind of food stuff you could imagine. All manner of snacks are available. What are you choosing to eat?
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing is that it depends on the film, actually. And also, you know, cinemas over the last, I don't know what, 10 years? 15 years maybe, have changed in terms of what you can get for food. I mean, when I was a kid, there were chocolates, there were popcorn, and there was pick and mix if you were lucky, and cold drinks, you know, and that was it, you know. And now, you know, I know some of the Odeons, you know, there's a full menu there, and that, it's a bit weird. It is still a bit weird. So I think for an action film, it's got to be silent. I don't, you know, crunchy kind of noisy stuff. But for an action film, I'll happily go for a burger and chips or something like that.
Okay.
I think I did with Top Gun Maverick, I think. I think I had burger and chips and that, which felt quite good. But then there's certain films where you kind of go, is it right to eat that? I mean, you know, Schindler's List. I mean, it just feels wrong to be getting your...
See your point. Yeah.
You're getting your bean burger and your chips or Sophie's Choice or something like that, you know.
So are we saying that... Snacks are for you maybe genre specific. So if I gave you a genre, you'd tell me the appropriate food to.
It's certainly genre impacted, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, for example, so burger and chips for action, yeah. Horror.
Horror. Popcorn is great for horror because actually that moment, you know, particularly with jump scares, where you see the popcorn of the people in front of you going into the air, I think is quite a special moment. And pick and mixes are fine, I think, for horror. Mm.
Documentary?
Again, it depends on the documentary, right. Really. You know, if it's kind of, you know, something like, I don't know, Searching for Sugar Man or something like that, you kind of want food because I think there's you know, it's artistic and all the rest of it. If it's, you know, Fahrenheit 9/11, then you just feel a bit weird going...
I see, yeah.
Oh, great, I've got the kind of, you know, candy bananas or whatever.
But you do have to have some food if people are eating on screen. I think there should be a warning that people eat delicious food in this movie as part of the story because the worst experience is to be hungry while watching people enjoy a meal in film.
That is very, very true, yeah, yeah. I mean, going back to the Bollywood experience, the thing that I did enjoy, actually, it was you got a cup of tea and you got samosas, and that was great. And samosas aren't entirely silent, to be quite honest, but there was something about that, and that was the other thing, you know, going back to the dads inevitably who'd queued up to get the tea and the samosas. The reason they were coming back in late after the intermission was that there'd be one quite old lady who was doing the lot, and so if you've got 1,000 people in a screen, and let's say, you know, conservatively, you know, 200 of them have gone to get teas and samosas, and each person is going to go there, he's not going to go, I'll have a tea and 2 samosas, please. It would be, I want 14 teas and 20 samosas. And they would be then, all these people would be kind of like carrying it. But it was like Buckaroo. You're going to give them one more thing and the whole thing would have gone. And but I have a great fondness for that. And so, I mean, ideally, yeah, I'd love to find a film or a genre of film other than Bollywood where I could have tea and samosas. Mm. Action films, probably. Because the thing is, you can crunch at the time there's a big explosion and all that sort of stuff. I am very mindful of that, actually.
That's, yeah, I like that. The consideration when it comes to snacking in the cinema is paramount.
Yeah, I mean, there have been times when I've anticipated an explosion on the screen and put something in my mouth and it's suddenly gotten really quiet and I've had to hold it there until the next moment there's a kind of car crash or something where I can crunch it.
That's consideration. That's next level consideration. Well, we have everything we need. Let's leave the foyer now and make our way towards the auditorium. So the corridor towards the auditorium is looking a little bare at the moment. What I'd like to do is put posters up to decorate it, featuring some of your most important movie memories. And the first poster I'd like to put up depicts your fondest movie memory.
You know, that's quite difficult. I've got quite a few. I mean, I loved the cinema. I mean, from when I was a kid, I think the first film I remember going to see, I remember kind of little snippets of films, and I'm kind of not sure exactly what they were. And that's when I was really little. But I think the first film that I absolutely kind of go, yeah, I saw that at the cinema, was probably Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. And that would have been 1968 or 69. So I was kind of 5 or 6 or something. But I remember that as just a fantastic experience because the songs are great. Mm. And the choreographed numbers are brilliant. But then you got the child catcher, who's frightening. And then who I didn't know at the time, was the king and queen under whose castle all the kids have been stowed away. The king was Gert Frobos, who was Goldfinger. That is a film I remember in its entirety going to see. So I love that. So that's great.
Was it like a roller coaster? I've heard it described. I've never seen Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, but for some people,
you haven't seen it.
I've never seen it. I'm not great with musicals. Mary Poppins, for some reason, touched my heart in a way that no other musical. I've tried. I've tried The Sound of Music. I've tried
West Side Story.
I've watched as part of my research. I've watched.
Not the whole film.
No.
Oh, wow, that's interesting. Singing in the Rain.
I've seen what's his?
Make Him Laugh.
Make Him Laugh.
Donald O'Connor.
Yeah,
Donald you haven't O'Connor. Seen the whole film?
No. Oh, man. I know. It's my...
That one you should see because it's about filmmaking. And so you just, I mean, it's funny and it's witty and it captures a moment in time.
It's my blank spot. That, weirdly, and Disney animation. But Chitty Chitty Bang Bang as a child, I've heard no...
Sorry, Disney animation.
Don't flip reverse this. Look, I brought the clipboard.
I'm just trying to cut out. I don't know. Look, I need to understand so I know where we're headed. It's
I've never seen The Lion King.
The Jungle Book.
No, I've seen the songs at various points. I've watched them on YouTube to understand the cultural reference point that
Aladdin.
They are. Weirdly, I have seen Aladdin. Okay. I've seen Aladdin because of Robin Williams' performance, yes.
And did you like it?
I loved it, yeah.
And still that wasn't a gateway to kind of...
No.
Man. That's, I don't know, that's either stoic or stupid. It's one of those things. It's a good and bad on that one.
It's one of the two S's, stoic or stupid, one of the two. But to go back to the point I was making, as a child, I've heard that no one had ever seen anything quite like the flying sequences in that car, the way the car moved and the screen moved. It was like a roller coaster almost.
Yeah, and also, at that scale, I mean, that's the other thing, which is kind of, that scale. And, movie memories thing, going to see Star Wars as a kid, was again the scale of it and the fluidity of the shots. You'd seen spaceships on telly and stuff, but the choreography of the action was incredible. And so that's a fantastic movie memory for me. Live and Let Die was the first Bond film I went to see at the pictures. I was a kid and we went as a family. My parents took me to see it. And that was an extraordinary experience because it was, again, the action in it is fabulous and it's quite tongue-in-cheek. And we as a family, we loved Roger Moore from the telly. And I got to be friends with, became friends with Roger, who was just wonderful, just a really wonderful guy.
I interviewed him once and I was just so gracious, just the way he held himself. You know how some people...
Yeah, yeah. There was a generosity about him, actually. I said to him once, I said, Roger, did I ever tell you that Live and Let Die was the first Bond film I went to see at the cinema? And he said, no. And I said, also it was the days of continuous programming. So basically you could buy your ticket in the morning. You'd sit there all day. Nobody turfed anyone out and you just sat wherever you sat. They weren't specific seats or anything. And I said, we watched the whole film and I thought, I'd really love the beginning and Paul McCartney's theme. And I'll watch that bit. And then I'll watch it up to the kind of boat chase because that's really great. And then the alligators bit is really great. I'll watch that. And I said, Roger, I sat there. I watched the whole film twice. And he kind of didn't miss a beat. And he said, you owe me £4.50.
Oh, I mean, you've also, over your career, having appeared in so many films, you've had the opportunity to experience the other side of the film experience, which is attending premieres as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of really, it's really weird. I haven't done that many, and so it's still really kind of quite special. And the first film that I appeared in at all was Notting Hill. And so nobody, I mean, I think had, goodness gracious me, I think the first series had gone out. And so that was amazing, attending the premiere of that. But then, I suppose the last one was yesterday, and that was the one time when I got to walk on stage, and that was, with Ed Sheeran and Himesh Patel and Lily James, Mira was in it as well, and that's really special actually. That was kind of something that sort of a greater involvement in, and so felt a little more justified in sort of being there and being up on the stage, and it is kind of. Yeah, it is amazing. It is amazing because in your head, particularly film fan like me, I mean, it links back to, you know, watching premieres on TV. I mean, I think, you know, I have a vague memory of a kid that if there was a big premiere on TV, there would be a TV program about it. I mean, they would, it'd be like a half hour thing of the interviews and the, all the rest of it. And, you know, it's always exciting when they have the big Leicester Square ones. A couple of which I've been to where you've been interviewing people on stage as they go in. I love all of that because it's again, it's scale. It kind of matches the idea of seeing a story on a giant screen with, you know, Dolby Atmos and, you know, that, everything that goes with it, as opposed to being in the home.
I personally enjoyed welcoming you all on stage at the Yesterday premiere. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. I did weirdly rewatch the Notting Hill scene that you're in. It's actually one of my favourite scenes in the movie. They talk about scenes as having, each scene should have its own mini arc in a film. You've got your overall arc of a film, but each scene should go on a journey. And that is a perfect example of that. It starts in one way. She's laughing, listening to you guys talking about her on another table. I'll let you explain it, actually.
In that particular sequence, Hugh Grant and Julia Roberts have gone out for a Japanese meal to a restaurant. And they overhear a group of city boys, I think they were described in the script, who are sitting around the corner talking about Julia Roberts' actress character. And basically, it starts from, isn't she gorgeous, to, you know, the word for actress and prostitute is the same in several, she's dirty. And Hugh Grant comes around to confront us and says, look, that's a person. I don't think you should be talking that. We tell him to piss off. And then Julia Roberts comes around and leaves us all open mouthed. And it was amazing. I remember kind of we had a very brief rehearsal in the restaurant before we shot the scene, and everyone was sitting down, and I was standing up, and Julia Roberts said, "Oh, you can sit here," and I said, "No, that's fine, that's fine." And she said, "No, I'll sit." And so she sat next to Hugh Grant, and I sat down, and the seat was still warm, and I couldn't get out of my head that this is Julia Roberts' bottom warmth. And I think I missed my cue. And it was a fantastic experience. And I love the film. But it was, and in a way, it was weird on the set of Paddington 2. I said, you know, perhaps a little desperately and extremely optimistically to Hugh Grant, who was brilliant in the film and great on set. And I said, Hugh, I said, look, it's you, me, Hugh Bonneville. This is a Notting Hill reunion, which is a bit desperate, isn't it, really? It's kind of like, oh, yeah, you very good. And you played second angry man in restaurant. So that's the reunion that everyone was waiting for.
Right, we're putting up a poster. So many options. Which would you like? We can only, we've only got space for one poster.
Gosh, that's kind of harsh, isn't it? Well, I'll tell you what. Okay, I was going to say Live and Let Die because, you know, became friends with Roger and that was great. But because I went up on stage and, you know, Ed Sheeran, who's become a bit of a mate, was there, and Mira was there, which was fantastic to share with her, and you were there, I'm going to go for Yesterday.
Yesterday. Putting up a poster for Yesterday. Any other movies?
But with a little picture of you kind of added in the corner to remind me why I said that, because I was being nice.
Now, who looks desperate? I believe that you are a huge champion of 1989 for two particular movies and repeatedly viewing them at the cinema.
I mean, for me, it was like a week and a half. So it was 10 days. And I basically found myself, you know, at a loose end for 10 days. And it just so happened to be the week that both the first Batman, Tim Burton's Batman, and Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade came out. And I kind of alternately watched them every day at the cinema. I love them. I mean, I absolutely love them. And Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade is probably my favorite of the three. I mean, I think Raiders is great, but that's my favorite of the three simply because the humor level, Sean Connery. I mean, you know, there was a father-son relationship in it, which was great. And, you know, it's, you know, beating up Nazis is always kind of great. I went to see each one about three times, I think, over about 8 days.
And the verdict at the end, it's kind of a bit like Sophie's Choice, but which was the better film?
I think, oh gosh, they were both just so good. But I think they were also, I think with Batman, you know, it was unexpected. Nobody, you know, because we'd had the Adam West TV series, which I loved, which was great, a great comedy. But no one knew quite what to expect from it. And especially casting Michael Keaton, who'd again done sort of like comedy roles. And he was great. The darkness in it was great. Jack Nicholson's Joker was unexpected. The soundtrack, which was, who did the soundtrack? It was
Danny Elfman.
Danny Elfman. The combination of Danny Elfman and Prince. I mean, all of it was just new. It felt new and dazzling and brilliant. But just for what it emotionally gave me, I think Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
Okay. I've led us away. We should be moving down the corridor because you've already picked your poster. We're sticking with yesterday with
a little picture of you on
a tiny, desperate picture of me going, I was there too. Okay, the second poster as we continue down the corridor that we're putting up depicts your worst movie memory.
Well, there are two films I wish I'd walked out of. But I didn't. I don't think I've ever walked out of a film.
I respect that. I have never walked out of a film. And I don't think you're allowed to say you've seen a film if you walk out of it.
Well, it's also the desperate hope that even in the last minute, there'll be something that redeems it. And then if it doesn't, then you go, maybe there's a post-credit sequence that will redeem the 2 hours of shite.
That features the best costume I've ever seen in a movie.
So the two that I wish I'd walked out of, actually, one was Young Einstein. You ever seen that?
God, I remember the poster where the guy's hair was crazy.
Yeah. Yahoo Serious.
That's right.
And he was an Australian kind of wunderkind at the time that he'd written, directed, and was starring in this film. And it cost, I don't know, you know, tuppence halfpenny to make. And it was basically this guy, the Einstein, the crazy hair was the Einstein reference.
Right.
But I remember seeing the trailer for it. I think I went to see it because nothing else was on. But I remember the trailer from it. There was one bit in the trailer where he said something like, I've just discovered how to split the beer atom. And I remember thinking afterwards, that should have told me, really. But I went, and I thought it was terrible. And costumes were all right. And the other one was, you know, one of those ill-fated sequels where you kind of go, really? Whose idea was this?
Can I guess?
Go on.
Is it Highlander 2?
It's not Highlander 2.
Okay.
It's older than that. It's impossible to give you clues about it. Well, all right, let's see if you can work it out. So, very prominent disaster movie from the early 70s.
Was it Multi-star, Return to Poseidon?
It was.
Oh!
It was.
Wow.
It was. you know, it was the idea that in the first film that Gene Hackman and... who was it? Shelley
Winters, yes.
You know, kind of like this upside down ship and it was still floating and they had to get their way to the... And you go, yeah, okay, all right, fine. The idea of the second film was we forgot some people in there. And so you go back to it and it was Michael Caine and I can't remember who else was in it. But also the only bits I remember from it now is the fact that it was now Michael Caine in the upside down ship, people who got left behind. So they're going, doing the same journey. But now, for some reason, Telly Savalas is in a kind of gunboat trying to blow it up. And it's kind of like, so I wish I'd walked out of that. Although neither of those is my worst movie memory.
Okay.
Now, the difficulty with this, in terms of the poster, is it will have to be a blank poster, which I'm good with.
Okay.
Because I can't remember the film. But I went on a blind date when I was at university with a girl.
A proper blind date.
Yeah, didn't know her. It was kind of like, it was introduced to her at this thing, and it was kind of, okay, should we go to the movies? And we went to the cinema, and it was packed. So it was obviously a film that had just come out. Obviously a film I wanted to see. And there used to be, at the time, a Southern Comfort ad, right, which was, and the soundtrack was, Why Do Fools Fall in Love, the Frankie Lyman song, right? And it was looked like it was in the Deep South and people were on the back of a pickup truck and they all drink Southern Comfort at the end and are all very, you know, happy and pleased with themselves. And So I really didn't know her. So we were sitting next to each other, sort of on the, as you face the screen, on the right-hand block of seats, about halfway up, but midway in. So we had people all around us. And so I said to her, I said, so where do you have any siblings? And then the advert came on and she started singing along to the song at the top of her voice. And I'm sort of staring at her, feeling extremely hot all of a sudden, but still trying to go, brothers, sisters, or, and she was looking at me and singing it at the top of her voice. You know, everyone was looking around. And it was that awful thing of then the advert finished, the film started, and all I was trying to guess with the film was, can I kind of guess, you know, 5 minutes before it ends so we can leave in the dark so no one sees us leave? It was, I mean, and to the extent I've blocked out the film.
So did you ask her what that was about, or did you never mention it again after the film had finished? Did you say the singing to the Southern Comfort advert was what was that? Why did you do that thing?
I mean, you know, obviously I've been in that situation where a song's come on and someone goes, oh, I really like this. And they go, I like that. Not at the top of your voice. I mean, that's just like you're performing it.
So do you think one of three things? Yeah. She was involved in music in some way. She was drunk or she was trying to impress you. Or perhaps a fourth version, she was mad.
Okay, good. I'm glad you added that in. The first one involved in music, no. The second one was...
Was she trying to impress you?
Was she trying to impress me? No, I don't think so, because she could have seen from my face that it wasn't working, so she couldn't read the room.
That she was a bit drunk? Maybe she was a bit drunk.
She wasn't drunk. That's kind right. of like, even then, because you're right, you could, you know, with all of those, you'd go, oh, perhaps, maybe. It was so traumatic that, yeah, we kind of left, and I can't remember the film at all.
And how was the second date?
Yes. The second date is yet to happen.
Yet.
But also, going back to your question about, you know, when we came out, did I say to her what I didn't? Because I didn't know whether to recall it would be some kind of trigger. And I thought, if I kind of casually... You know, you have a drink afterwards or something and you go, hey, you obviously love music. I mean, is that a particular song? And she goes, what? I said, the song that you were singing and thing, that she might just take out a knife and stab me. And I thought, I don't want to bring it up. So it was too, even now, I feel quite jittery about it.
Wow. All right. A blank poster is going up, which I think is great, because I don't know that you want to be remembered when you revisit this cinema in the future about that particular event. Okay. Our third poster depicts the last performance that brought you to tears.
I mean, it was probably, gosh, it was probably on telly, actually. Well, I think, gosh, I don't know if it was the last one. Maybe it was. I kind of caught, by chance, actually, at home, flicking channels. The kind of, was it 7 minute sequence in Up?
Oh, yes.
Near the beginning of the film.
Yep.
Which I think is one of the greatest sequences in film, because I think, you know, again, you know, you were saying about mini arcs, and you go, in 7 minutes, you tell not just a story and a history, but everything you need to know about the guy in the present without a word. It's genius. It's absolute genius. And I remember the first time, I mean, even thinking about it, it was making me sort of well up, but it was also, I think you kind of weirdly can, well, you're not, because of, you know, your kind of stoicness towards Disney animation.
We can call it stupid. It's fine.
but you know, when, you know, you grew up being, or certainly you were, you know, conditioned to think that animation films were for children. And so the amazing thing about Pixar and where they were a game changer was suddenly these films became, you know, multi-layered. And I think, you know, at their best, Pixar are genius. They're genius. And that was so unexpected so early in the film. Because, again, because most films, which are about entertainment, will, I think, kind of, you know, try to lay that ground first. And then the moving stuff comes later or towards the end. You know, it's so you've laid that ground and you're in a happy place. And then you go with the kind of emotional kind of direction that the film wants you to take. This was really early on. And so that's an incredibly bold thing to do. But also so utterly, heartbreakingly beautiful to do. You know, in that 7 minute, you know, you got their entire life. They got the whole story about why they don't have kids and why she isn't there anymore. And then ultimately why he's doing what he's doing. You know, because the poster was, you know, the balloons on the thing and you go, oh, that's quite amusing. Yeah. Well, when you know the kind of, you know, the significance, I think it's amazing.
And that. You were talking about triggers, music being triggers in your last poster, but that Michael Giacchino score.
It's just.
It's a trigger.
Beautiful.
It's a trigger.
No, for me as well. For me as well. I think it's just beautiful. It's one of the soundtracks that I've kind of got on my kind of playlists and stuff like that. It's utterly beautiful, but also such a funny film. Such a funny film, but with so much ingrained meaning to it about why we're here, what meaning we give to our own existence. And that's extraordinary for an animation.
It's possibly my favorite Pixar movie purely because, as you just mentioned, it does it breaks your heart. And then because I like stupid humor, Kevin and the dog, that combined double act is.
We still at home, if we want to kind of, you know, get a cheap laugh, we'll mid conversation just squirrel. We'll just throw that in. I think it's beautiful. I think, you know, Inside Out, I think, is also, you know, a fabulous film, which is so beautifully layered. Coco, I think, was stunning, you know, visually stunning, but again, you know, has great meaning to it. But Up was the one that I think just threw me. And I think that, again, that sequence in particular, and hopefully, you know, people who've seen it will know what I'm talking about. I think it's just is extraordinary filmmaking.
A poster for Up is going up, and it's time for our final poster. And this final poster before we enter the auditorium depicts your unpopular movie opinion.
Okay. Well, generally, that means, you know, that there's a film that either you like that everyone hates.
Agreed.
Or there's a film that you hate that everyone likes.
Right.
Isn't it? I think, okay, it's going to be the one that I loved and not many people either liked or went to see. I think that, okay, there's two. Okay, there's two that come to mind. You can choose in terms of the posters, right? One is What Dreams May Come, Robin Williams' film about the afterlife, which I think is absolutely wonderful. I think it's beautiful. I think it's brilliant. I think a lot of people will find it mawkish, but I found it incredibly moving. The depiction of the afterlife, I thought, was unique and wonderful, but not very popular as a film.
Have you seen it? I have not seen it, but in preparation for this moment, I will say I've done a lot of crying in preparation for this interview, more than any other guest I've had on, between The Sandman, between obviously Up, and now watching the trailer for this morning. I haven't even seen the film, but I understand the principle. He goes to the afterlife, and it's the moment where he meets his dead dog in the trailer and the joy on his face. Now, I don't even need to see the movie to be overwhelmed with emotion seeing that.
It's more of the same. I think it starts off, you know, it's so bleak in terms of, you know, where people, why do you have a reason to exist when awful, terrible, tragic stuff happens to you. And the film starts with that, which is not, you know, the most reassuring place to start. But I saw it with Mira. We were in New York and it was on at cinema and we kind of wanted to go to the pictures and we said, oh, well, let's have a look at this. I don't know what this is about, really. We knew it wasn't a Robin Williams funny film. And I can't remember the name of the director. It was the
Victor
New Zealand.
Victor Ward? I think it's Victor Ward. I think it's a guy called Victor Ward. I only know that because he was initially involved in, which is more my arena, Alien 3, and then he left that for various reasons, as many people did. But I'm pretty sure Victor Ward directed it. I may be wrong.
I think it was the guy who did Flight of the Navigator. Who did Flight of the Navigator? Wasn't it him?
Funnily enough, no signal in a basement. Yeah. But
that's beat. No signal in a sub. It's a really beautiful film, actually. It will make you cry. But
it wasn't well liked.
No, it wasn't. And I kind of now can't remember the details of the reviews, but I can understand why people wouldn't like it. I think people are kind of uncomfortable about films. Actually, there's not a plethora of films about the afterlife.
No.
There's Heaven Can Wait and one of my favorites, actually, which is the David Niven one, the classic Powell and Pressburger one, Matter of Life and Death.
Okay.
Which I think is beautiful, beautiful, beautiful film.
It's quite weird, isn't it, having to envisage the afterlife? I think some of the reviews were like, while the themes of the film are fascinating, the visualization of the afterlife is horribly literal. It's sort of too saccharine, too predictable, was what some of the reviews said.
Yeah. I mean, each to their own. I think the thing is that, okay, here's an interesting thing, or possibly not. I'll let you decide. But I remember when I did a documentary about Bollywood films, right? And I interviewed a Bollywood director. And I said, okay, I said, look, you know, in the West, when you show Bollywood films with a Western sensibility, Western eyes, you kind of look at it and you go, it's really long. The hero is uber heroic, you know, and, you know, the songs, people burst into songs. They kind of like, you know, change costumes, you know, five times during the songs. They change locations kind of five times during the songs. You know, they start a song and they're in a room and, you know, one of them will turn around and they're on top of a mountain in Switzerland or something. And I said, you know, how do you kind of regard that view that this is kind of, you know, nonsensical and silly and all the rest of it? And he said, okay, he said, look, there's a different way of approaching watching these films. He said, what you do, he said, pointing at me, so you will watch a film to understand its sequential logic. You know, how do we go from A to B? C, do we refer back to B? And then when we get to D, so you're making those constructions. He said, if you watch a Bollywood film, it's very much the same rule if you watch a musical, actually, which obviously you ain't done. he said, if you follow the emotional logic, then the sequential logic doesn't matter.
Right.
So he said, in that moment when in a Bollywood film, your hero is surrounded by 10 guys with machine guns, and he's armed with a spoon, and he beats them up, right? It's not because it's silly and stupid, because logically it doesn't make any sense. But emotionally, you know, it's about good over evil. Mm. And so he said within the songs, when someone turns around and they're on top of a mountain in Switzerland, and then they turn around and they're in Hawaii or whatever, he said it's about interpreting the emotion of the song. So he said it's not important that they're on a mountain in Switzerland. It's the feeling of being there. It's the feeling of being on the ocean or whatever. And I thought that's a really interesting way to watch films. And so I think going back to What Dreams May Come, I watched it with those eyes, which is if you follow the emotional logic, which is this guy who suffers all these tragedies and then effectively goes into the afterlife to save the people he loves. It's you kind of go, okay, if I follow that emotional logic, then all those things about the depiction of it is a separate thing. That's a kind of artistic kind of decision. But that doesn't impact your feeling of the journey. Mm. And so it's a great way sometimes just to step away from this film doesn't make any sense and go, how does it make me feel? How from sequence to sequence, where is the emotion leading me? And so that's why I think it's an extraordinary.
Okay.
Or the kid with Bruce Willis.
Okay, curveball.
Yeah, that which I kind of, again, I don't think I've seen it since I first watched it. And I found it really, really moving about, so essentially it's this guy, it was a Disney film, and it's this guy who's, you know, very successful, very ambitious, businessman, works in advertising and all that kind of stuff, which was always a shorthand for ruthless ambition if he wasn't in the city. And a kid turns up at his house one day, comes home, finds this kid there, and he goes, "What the heck is this?" And he realizes that it's his younger self. And it's just about how we grow up. And so many of the things that we carry are negatives about our younger selves. You know, looking at our younger selves and going, "God, you were an idiot. God, you were stupid. You know, I'm glad I'm not you anymore." And it's a really beautiful film about that. How do you, put that to bed? How do you make peace with kind of being disappointed with your younger self? You know, it's all those things where you kind of look at decisions you've made when you were younger and go, "God, you're an idiot. God, you're an idiot. God, I wish I hadn't been an idiot." And you kind of want to go, really? Because, you know, your younger self was last week. It was yesterday. It was kind of, stretching back to when you were, 8, 9, 10 or whatever. You made the decision that you did based on who you were at that time. And so one of the essential things about healing that is to be able to look at your younger self and to be able to say, you did that because you were scared, because you just didn't know, because, you had phobias because of whatever. And you just want to really be able to put your arm around that younger person and go, "It'll be all right. It'll be okay. It'll be all right. We'll work it out."
I'm worried that beautiful description of Bruce Willis's The Kid, if someone hears that and goes to watch The Kid, are you certain what you just described is the movie they are going to get?
No, probably not, because they'll probably go, "What is this saccharine shit that I've been dealt with in this Disney-fied way?" But I followed it from an emotional, logical viewpoint. Mm. Because otherwise it is kind of like, well, how can his younger self suddenly turn up in his house?
Sure.
How does that work? Because we look for the mechanisms. Mm. And so, a great example of one, of a great film that gets around that, which we don't question, is Groundhog Day. We don't question the construction of it. We kind of go, well, how is he living the same day? And kind of, what is it? Is it a magic spell? Is it kind of, it doesn't matter, because the emotional logic of it is kind of what happens to Bill Murray's character, where he ends up. Other films we kind of go, "No, I'm not going to do that."
That's a testament to a good film, because every single film, even the greatest film on this planet, if you chose to start picking away at its logic, then you will find plot holes, undoubtedly. And it's to do with whether the film is good enough to cover up those inevitable plot holes.
No, you're absolutely right. In fact, I took my son and a friend of his to see Paddington 2. Mm-hmm. And at the end of it, my son had already seen it and he loved it. And I love it. I think it's
fantastic.
Near on a perfect film.
Oh, yeah.
But my son's friend said, and I said, "Did you like it?" And he went, I mean, "Look, there's a talking bear wandering around London and nobody kind of goes, what about the talking bear?" And you kind of go, "There's nothing I can do for you. There's absolutely nothing I can do for you."
Okay, so it's either The Kid or What Dreams May Come. I can tell you that The Kid is the worst reviewed of the two films.
Oh, is it?
But it's up to you. Which poster do you want to put up?
I would, if one of those two films I'd love you to watch, it would be What Dreams May Come.
Okay, so you are saying What Dreams May Come, a very poorly reviewed film, is a masterpiece.
I do think it's a masterpiece.
What Dreams May Come. That is our final poster. Right, let's get into the auditorium. Okay, we push open our final doors. Now, there is a queue of people wanting to join you in the auditorium. Are you going to let them in to join you and Elvis to watch this film, or would you like an exclusive empty cinema for just you and the king?
Oh, gosh. Elvis changes the dynamic somewhat, doesn't it? No, I'd want some people in there. I don't want it to be packed.
Okay.
Because everyone will be just looking at Elvis.
Okay, well, the ones that you've let in go wild. They're thrilled to be part. The others shuffle out, despondent, gloomy, and unlikely to watch Paddington 2 in the future. Right, before we get to the movie you've picked for us, there's a few things we're going to play on the screen. And the first thing is a trailer. And it's a trailer for the film you are most looking forward to right now.
Right now? Gosh. Well, actually, of the trailers that I've seen, I'm quite excited by Oppenheimer. Mm-hmm. I was very excited for Indy 5.
Are you slightly sad, though? Because he has said this is it. Not only is Harrison Ford retiring after this film retiring the character Indiana Jones, but the character itself is never going to be recast.
Won't it?
No, he said the character, there'll be undoubtedly, they're going to make more indie films, but it'll be like indie legacy films where someone else is playing a different character in the Indiana Jones universe. But we'll never see another Indiana Jones.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I mean, some trepidation after Indy 4, I have to say.
I did note earlier that you went, of the three, as though it didn't even exist.
Yeah, Indy 4, because the opening of Indy 4, I think, is great. It opens with Hound Dog, which kind of, you know, of course I'm going to be partial to it.
You must have been on cloud nine at that point, like, oh my God, Elvis, Indiana Jones, what are those gophers doing? What?
I thought, well, the gopher, okay, let it go. It's really early on in the film. And when by the end of it, I was going, oh. But I thought the trailer looked great. Mm. And I'd read some criticism of, you know, de-aging him for some of the scenes and stuff. I don't mind that at all. I was quite excited to see those kind of younger indie kind of dealing with stuff. But I'm not going to choose either of those, even though I'm really looking forward to both of those, and I will go and see them as quickly as possible. I think the one that really made me, you know, my head kind of turn was Asteroid City, Wes Anderson's thing. Because I don't think anybody makes a film that looks like Wes Anderson's films. And it's one of those things where I will always love a filmmaker for reaching something, for reaching for something, you know, and I don't mind sometimes that it's not amazing or brilliant or whatever. And so, you know, whether it's Terrence Malick or whether it's Terry Gilliam or, you know, these people are kind of, they have a unique vision, but, and absolutely Wes Anderson does. And so that was the thing that I'd looked at, the trailer, and I thought, I really want to see that on a big screen.
It's, I think this is his 11th film it's going to be, so he's got 10 films, and he's not made a bad film. He's a filmmaker who's made 10 films, which isn't a small number, and every single one is brilliant. Do you have a favourite?
Probably Budapest Hotel, but I really like, you know, Fantastic Mr. Fox was really unexpectedly brilliant. I thought it'd be good, but in his hands, it just felt different, you know. Last one, was it French Dispatch was the last one?
Yeah.
Which a lot of people didn't like, but I quite liked it. There were bits of it I wasn't hot on, but I thought as an overall thing, I thought it was great.
Yeah, it's for me, one of them is fantastic. It vies between Fantastic Mr. Fox and The Royal Tenenbaums. I have a real...
Oh, which is great. Mm. Yeah, yeah. But as you say, each one of them has got something to it. The Life Aquatic, was that?
With Steve Zissou.
Which I didn't see when it came out, and I saw it a few years later. And again, it was just, it's quirky. It's quirky in a, you know, Wes Anderson way, but not in a way that, it never feels like there's a filmmaker saying, I want you to like me.
Mm.
He's just going, this is my view of the world. And
I think like you say, I think that's what The French Dispatch was. He is going to make the films he wants to make. Because I watched the trailer for that and I was like, oh, I think this might be the first I don't like. Then I watched it. I was like, nope, it's got everything
right.
I really enjoyed. So trailers can be misleading, I guess is the bottom line. Right, we're playing the trailer for Asteroid City. And next up, as a little warm-up, we're going to play your favorite shot or sequence or moment in a movie.
Well, I mean, I did mention, you know, the scene from Up, I think, is genius as a sequence. It's brilliant. But the one sequence that, you know, will kind of, I may find it difficult to get through without getting teary alongside. I mean, I couldn't go into too many details about the sequence from Up because I know I'd get teary. But the other one, which I think shares a DNA with that sequence, is the last scene in Chaplin's City Lights. And it's extraordinary. I think so. City Lights, Chaplin made City Lights when sound had come in, but he chose to make it as a silent film. And it's about, you know, the tramp, little tramp character who befriends a flower girl. And she thinks he's a millionaire because she heard a car door slam at the point that he came up to her. And so
she's blind, isn't she?
She's blind, yeah. Right. Yeah. And so he kind of endeavors to raise enough money for her to have an eye operation that will cure her of her sight. And, you know, no spoiler, but, you know, he gets the money through a series of kind of hilarious mishaps. And she regains her sight. And he then realizes that if she sees him, she's going to know he's just a tramp. He's not this millionaire guy. So he can't go anywhere near her. You know, he's got to keep away from her. And the last sequence in the film is that he is being kind of, you know, mocked by kids because, you know, his pants are sticking out of his trousers and his shoes got a hole in it and the rest of it. And he accidentally walks past the flower shop in which this girl who can now see is working. And he's absolutely besotted and drawn in. That's the girl he's kind of gone through hellfire to kind of raise money for. And it worked and it's fine. And she sees him. And somebody in the shop says, oh, I think you've got an admirer. And she comes out of the shop to give him a coin. He's a tramp. So she you know, proffers this coin. Now, he knows he can't say anything because if he speaks, she's going to know it's him. So he says nothing. And she goes, you know, do you want the coin? Take the coin. And he's just staring at her. He can't say. And she grabs his hand and puts the coin in it and recognizes his hand from the touch thing. And she kind of looks at him and he says, I am getting well enough. He says something like, I can't remember word for word. He says, oh, you can see now. And she says, I can see everything. It's just beautiful. It's just beautiful. And I remember thinking at the time, that's as far as you could take silent film. It's kind of, there's a reason for his silence in a film which was made when, you know, talkies were available. I think it's just the most amazing, beautiful, moving end to a journey.
And that was the final time I cried in preparation for this interview, because as a testament to that scene, I had not seen the film, but I did think I'll read the plot on Wikipedia. And even just reading the plot and then watching that scene on YouTube, I was in tears by the end. It's incredible.
It's beautiful. It's just beautiful. And it's, again, you know, it's worth seeing the film because he was, you know, possibly the first complete filmmaker, you know, understood film as a medium, but, you know, he produced and he wrote and he directed and, you know, acted in it, obviously, and then could do the music for it and, you know, edited it. I mean, he was possibly, you know, the first complete filmmaker, but that was incredible. I think it's an incredible sequence.
Yeah, and you drew a comparison to Up at the start, and I saw the same thing, even down to the scores. I wondered if there was an intentional mimicry.
Oh, that's
mimicry,
interesting. Yeah, that's very interesting.
Okay, right. Now, you've done a really lovely thing. You've printed out T-shirts for our audience with your favourite movie quotes on the front.
Nice of me, isn't it?
Well, so for the ones who you let in, yeah, it's nice. Yeah. It's nice
well,
for them.
I can't wait to see Elvis wearing this one.
So what is your favourite movie quote?
I mean, there are so many great quotes, aren't there? But the one that always amuses and entertains me, and there is little story to it, is by Grabthar's hammer, by the sons of Warven, you shall be avenged, from Galaxy Quest. And there's a line in the film, I mean, the character played by Alan Rickman. Mm. And it's, for those people who don't know, it's kind of like a Star Trek type series, which has gone into syndication, and it was made many years ago. And, you know, the stars of the series now just only go to conventions and things. And they are suddenly kind of approached and ultimately employed without them fully knowing what's going on. They think it's a gig by real aliens who are being attacked by some sort of horrible warlord.
You must help us.
Yes.
Their voices.
It's great.
Wonderful.
The Thermians. So suddenly you've got these people who are in this, you know, in this spaceship that's been built to the specifications of, you know, the show that they were on, who've got to do battle with this guy. They're a bunch of actors. They've never done anything without scripts. And so Alan Rickman plays the kind of Spock type character in it. who he was a Shakespearean actor who's, this is the only thing he's ever done since. He's got to wear a plastic head. He's really quite bitter about it. And he's got this catchphrase that he hates. And my favorite rendition of it is, it's great actually, that it, you know, the catchphrase is set up quite early on, but it pays off in quite a moving way in the film, which is beautifully done. But there's a bit where they're kind of required, the cast, to open a kind of Radio Shack type place. And, you know, they've got to say things like, you know, the prices are out of this world and sort of various space related things. And he's got the last line and he says, by Grabthar's hammer, what a saving. And he does it with such pain that I said to Alan Rickman once, I'm really, really grateful that I got the opportunity to tell him in person. And I said, Alan, I said, can I just say that, you know, by Grabthar's hammer, what a saving. I think it's one of the best delivered lines in movie history. And he said, I'm so glad you think that. He said, I love that film. I wish it had done better.
That's, I'm so pleased he loves it. That's great to hear.
Yeah, it was great that he loved the film and that he loved somebody else loving the film. But again, you know, somebody you mentioned earlier on, Sam Rockwell. It's just brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah.
As the guy who was an extra in the series. Now he's along for this and immediately regretting it because he's the one that's going to be killed and eaten by monsters or something.
Yeah. If anyone hasn't seen Galaxy Quest, it is genuinely one of the great cinema comedies. And it's such a shame that it's obviously garnered a huge following now and become, as every film that doesn't do well over the years, becomes a cult classic. This is a truly magnificent film.
See, but that is the beauty of film, actually, is that, you know, films are very much judged on their box office, you know, and, you know, what was their first weekend and how much did it cost and how much did it make? But, you know, the beauty of it is that, you know, they last forever. And if 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, now even, you know, up to 100 years old, it can still move and touch someone and be meaningful to someone. That's an extraordinary thing. You know, again, going back to, you know, why I think it's the greatest art.
I mean, we're sitting here talking about City Lights, which is 1931, and here we are in 2023 talking about how it's one of the most moving moments in cinema.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Right then, one final thing to do before you announce the movie you've picked for us, and that is to play a little bit, or maybe the whole thing, depending on how much time we have in the cinema, of your favourite score or song from a film.
Score or song? Mm. Wow, that's really, really hard.
You can only pick one, I'm afraid. If you can't have a score and a song, I've got to be strict.
Okay, all right. So you couldn't pick a jukebox movie soundtrack?
All right, fine. Yes, you could.
I'm not going to.
About unpicking plot holes.
I do think that's cheating. I do think that's cheating. But it's really difficult. I love film soundtracks. I absolutely love coming here today on the tube. I had my sort of movies playlist and was playing stuff. And it is kind of, you know, the composer, I guess, I've grown up with in terms of my cinema going years has been John Williams. Mm-hmm. And he's fabulous, you know, obviously the Star Wars and Indiana Jones stuff, but also Catch Me If You Can, which is a completely different kind of soundtrack to the ones that people associate with John Williams. So he's been great. David Arnold, what he did with the Bond films, I thought was fantastic. Michael Giacchino that you mentioned.
Yeah.
You know, the variety of stuff that he did. Up was brilliant. Inside Out, I think he did. He did the Star Trek reboot, which I think is a fantastic soundtrack. But going back to, you know, I think two of the greatest movie themes ever are the James Bond theme and the Pink Panther theme. And both of those encapsulate everything about the character. And that's brilliant, you know. John Barry and Henry Mancini on those ones. So it's really difficult. You go back, Alex North, I think, is amazing. Bernard Herrmann, I think, is amazing. Daniel Pemberton. I mean, I think his soundtrack for Amsterdam in the last year was my favorite soundtrack. And I loved his soundtrack for Man from U.N.C.L.E., which I thought was, just really fun. But I'm going to go with the soundtrack that I think I've listened to the most. Ennio Morricone was kind of amazing and changed things in terms of movie soundtracks. But So just for ease sake, because I can't choose between any of those, I'm going to go for the one that I've listened to the most, I think, over the years. And that's Vangelis's soundtrack for Blade Runner, that first Blade Runner. Because I think it was the first time I was aware of the soundtrack being so much more than music. You know, there was a kind of sound bed. So that opening sequence of the city and the kind of bass notes that come through, yeah. It's just as you build those, you know, synth sounds that kind of hold at the back before you get the tunes. And then in terms of the soundtrack itself, just the variety within it. You know, you've got an old-fashioned 1940s type song that's thrown in there. I think it's amazing.
I mean, because you mentioned it, like Michael Giacchino, and the trigger that is to take you back to that moment in Up, I think Vangelis and his score for Blade Runner inhabit that same place where you cannot separate the music from the film. Like the moment you just mentioned, you hear that opening, and you're looking, you're seeing Rutger Hauer's eye and the flames from the Tyrell Tower.
Hans Zimmer does a similar job now, I think, with soundscapes to things, which I think is amazing. But I worked with Rutger Hauer, and he was so lovely. It was a kind of little sitcom thing, and he was doing a bit in that, and I did kind of, it was one of those things we agonize about and up to it, but I kind of said, "Hi, Rutger, are you just sick of it? If I bring it up, are you sick of it?" And he said, what are you gonna? And I said, I mean, you know, I can imagine that you've seen things. And he laughed, and then he kind of very, very generously said, which has always stayed with me, because it's, you know, if I had a review in something, this is what I'd want it to say. He said, "I was watching you in the scene, and you're so good, I wanted to lick your face." It's just great. He was so lovely.
About your performance in the scene in the sitcom.
Yeah, yeah. Which is really lovely. And it didn't matter if he didn't mean it. It was just a wonderful thing to hear from him.
It would have mattered if he'd done it, but...
You're right. You know, if he'd attempted, I'm not sure what I would have done. I would have probably stepped back a bit and go, "Hey, Rutger."
You wouldn't. Yeah, it's Rutger Hauer. What's this kind of...
Yeah, there is that as well. It was, you know, obviously very, very sad when he passed away.
Right then. Vangelis, the score from Blade Runner. Sadly missing from Blade Runner 2049. I believe because he said there are things that can only exist once and I just could not repeat it. I think he compared it to Chariots of Fire and the fact that it's unrepeatable.
Yeah, although I have to say, you know, the Hans Zimmer score for that I thought was great because it kind of captured the mood of Vangelis's score. But again, it's that combination of, again, seeing it for the first time on a big screen and that opening moment. As you say, you can't dissociate the sound from what you're seeing on screen, and that's magical.
You know where we are? We're at the climax of our night. We've arrived. We've been on such a journey, and now we're here. It's time for you, Sanjeev, to announce to this semi-packed auditorium and the king himself, Elvis Presley, the movie you have picked of all others to play for us tonight.
Well, I was hoping to go for a double bill, but maybe, you know, if you're not going to allow that, then probably the first film.
Do you really want a double bill?
I don't think either of the films are that long. It's not like, you know, I've gone, let's have Dr. Zhivago and Lawrence of Arabia.
All right. Do you know what? Why not? Have a double bill.
Well, they are linked. Okay. And Elvis would have seen one of them, and I would have been interested in what he had to say about the other. So it's a Python-related double bill. I think Life of Brian as the first one, because I'd love to have seen that with Elvis. But also, I think that, you know, it's a film that arguably would not be allowed to be made today. But I think it's still the best film which satirizes the division of people and religion and belief and the rest of it. It's an incredibly political film. And, you know, the fact that it ends with, you know, always look on the bright side of life, is there can be no kind of more sound message to give to people. especially now, because you kind of go, the context is at some point you're going to be popping your clogs. And so make the best of it for yourself and for everyone else. What the heck, you know?
I think my favorite fact about that ending, which sort of spoils it for me a little bit, once you know the backstory, is the fact they're all on the crucifixes and everyone's in a loincloth apart from, you know, the story.
John Cleese refused to cut it. But also, I had the great joy of watching it once with Terry Jones.
Oh my God.
And so he talked me through the film. So it was like having, you know, the kind of director's commentary
live
in and out. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Sitting next to him. And he said to me, as that last sequence came up, he said, if you look really carefully, he said, look, the sequence coming out, look at the bottom of the screen. And there's a bloke who wandered into the set who they didn't realize was there until they'd got afterwards. It was pre-paint box days. You couldn't paint it out. Very, very little. And also the other fact that I love about that, that is at the beginning of the film, when people are going to the Sermon on the Mount to see Christ give his Sermon on the Mount, there's a whole line of people that are walking up a hill. And they were going to shoot that and then realize they'd broken everyone for lunch. So that shot of everyone is all of all the extras heading to the catering truck to get lunch. That's the shot when they're all walking up.
That's a great fact. Yeah. That is a great fact. Okay, so Life of Brian is opening our double bill. What is closing it?
Brazil. Because again, I think it's one of the greatest films ever made. And I think that, again, that combination of horror, humor, satire, and the fact, the very profound idea that in the end, the only escape from madness is a slightly better madness, I think is quite profound.
That's a lovely, lovely double bill. And that's it, Sanjeev. The curtains have closed. The guests are milling out, smiling, chatting, and thanking you for taking them on an incredible night at the cinema. But before you go, it's time for this week's mystery question as we ask, what's in the box?
Okay.
I saw you with the box. What was in the box?
Oh, what's in the box?
This week's mystery question. Okay. If the phone rang tomorrow and it was an offer for you to bring any literary character in the world to the big screen, who would that character be?
Wow, any literary character.
Any literary character. But any,
I mean, a lot of literary characters obviously have made their way to the big screens, haven't they?
Yeah.
So one that hasn't been...
Or perhaps a personal reimagining of an existing literary character.
Reimagining? Gosh.
Yeah, I hate that word. I'm so sorry. It's overused. It's terrible. I think once you saw Tim Burton's reimagining of Planet of the Apes, we stopped saying reimagining.
So, what you know, one of the... I mean, wonderful costumes. But I would love to see a kind of series of movies, maybe a franchise of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I think they had a kind of noble attempt at a film, but I think there was a lot of, it seemed like there was a lot of kind of studio influence on it. Whereas I think actually the books are quite subversive. And the other one actually, Douglas Adams's characters that has been on the small screen, but never on a big screen, has been Dirk Gently, Holistic Detective. And I think that would be perfect for a big screen treatment. I mean, the Long Dark Tea Time of the Soul, which was the second of the books, has got some fabulous sequences. I can't remember if it's the first or second one, where he's brought in to kind of solve a mystery because somebody on a suburban street saw Thor hurtling down the street with Molyneux, the hammer, and everything was being shattered. And they were going, how the hell did he get here? And Dirk Gently character, the holistic detective, finds that there is a molecule in St. Pancras Station, which if you can find that molecule and just turn within it, around it, you'll find yourself in Valhalla. And you kind of go, that's perfect for the big screen. So actually, because they've already had a go at that one, I'm going to go Dirk Gently.
I love it. I love it. And it's weird that you mentioned that because that's another Douglas Adams book that I have read. And And every time I'm standing on the concourse at St. Pancras Station, I think of that moment.
Do you know what? I try to look for it. I try to find it. I do weird little... So if you see me doing very strange, slow, deliberate turns, that's what I'm trying to do.
It's our platform 9.5. That's what it is. Right, that's it. The curtains have finally closed. Your taxi has arrived to ferry you back to reality. But before you go, let's recap your perfect night out at the cinema. So you are going with Elvis Presley, the king himself, at 5 p.m. You're sitting in the middle, in the center. You're having all sorts of snacks, samosas, tea, burger, and chips, but you're not going to crunch those samosas if there's not an explosion on screen, and there are very few in the life of Brian in Brazil. You're going to be sucking on those samosas. We're putting up films that celebrate your fondest movie memory. It was the premiere of Yesterday. Your worst movie memory. It's just a blank poster because no one wants to remember being sang at volume in a cinema. The third poster that brought you to tears is that montage from Up. And our fourth poster is that your unpopular opinion is that the poorly reviewed and little seen Robin Williams movie What Dreams May Come is in fact a masterpiece. The trailer we're playing is for Asteroid City. We're playing your favourite shot and sequence from a movie, which is the end of City Lights. We are then going to be putting on a T-shirt by Grabthar's Hammer. What a saving. Before we listen to the score from Vangelis and enjoy a double bill of Life of Brian and Brazil, Sanjeev, thank you. Have you had a good time?
I've had a most amazing time. I just never thought I'd get Elvis to kind of wear a, you know, by Grabthar's Hammer T-shirt and sit next to me eating samosas, watching a Python-related double bill.
He's a very naughty boy. Thank you so much, and it's been a pleasure.
This has just been so much fun.
And as Sanjeev's cab carries him away from our virtual cinema, off into the distance, we must all leave his movie paradise and return to reality. But to soften the blow, how would you like a pair of tickets for a night out at a very real Odeon cinema? Each week, we give away a pair to someone who leaves us a review of the show on Apple Podcasts. It's that simple. The competition is only open to UK residents, and the tickets exclude Odeon Leicester Square and Odeon Lux. If I read out your review on next week's show, we'll be sending you a pair of tickets to an Odeon cinema. And just before I say my final farewell for this episode, don't forget you can find the full video for today's Sanjeev interview, and indeed for every guest on our Trip to the Movies YouTube channel. So please head over there and help us grow the podcast by subscribing. And that really is it. I'll be back next week, though, when another guest fills our cinema with their celluloid dreams as they take us on a trip to the movies. Bye-bye.